Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So welcome all to our discussion on the topic of remembering Senator Neville Bonner. As I said before, it's unfortunate at the time of pandemic that we can't have person-to-person meetings. On the other hand, it's great that we can bring in some of our supporters and members who live outside of Sydney for these discussions. Now, as usual, I'll be very brief in my introduction. We're very grateful that Michelle Grattan makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's well known to all of you. She's a professorial fellow at Canberra University and political correspondent for the Conversation, and Associate Professor Michael Reynolds, who works in physiotherapy at the Australian Catholic University. So we're going to lead off with Michelle Grattan, who's going to talk for 15 or 20 minutes about Neville Bonner, and then we'll go to Michael Reynolds, and then we go to questions and discussion, and we finish no later then, but perhaps before the top of the hour. So Michelle Grattan, thank you very much, and off you go.
Thanks very much, Gerard, and good to be with everyone this evening to remember Neville Bonner and discuss some of the aspects of his career and his legacy. Today, there are seven federal parliamentarians who identify as Indigenous, one Liberal, three from the ALP, two Greens, and crossbencher Jackie Lambie. Another is certain of election next year, Jacinta Price from the Northern Territory, who will sit in the Coalition Party room. Ken Wyatt is the first Indigenous Minister for Indigenous Australians. The arrival of Indigenous members into Parliament is no longer seen as extraordinary. But how different 50 years ago, when Neville Bonner filled a Queensland casual Senate vacancy. His very presence was a huge attention grabber. Then, soon after his maiden speech, he gave a boomerang-throwing display on the parliamentary lawns, at which he actually climbed a tree to retrieve one of his boomerangs, saying it was a very good one and he didn't want to lose it. And he had, after all, previously had a business making boomerangs. Bonner, in the Senate from 1971 to 1983, was a man of his time, but he was also one who transcended his time. The story of his ascent to the Senate was remarkable, especially because he was on the conservative side of politics. It's an important milestone for Indigenous Australians, wherever people might stand individually on the political spectrum. Bonner overcame a deprived and difficult childhood, a lack of formal education, the conservatism of the Queensland Liberal Party, the hostility of many Indigenous militants, among other challenges. He fought battles and won respect within both the white world and the Aboriginal world, but he didn't want to see a deepened divide between the two. He wanted one community. He got into conflicts, but he more often pursued compromise. He had to deal with his own version of identity politics as he sought to juggle, not always successfully, representing his state, his party, and Aboriginal people. He wanted recognition for the fundamental place of Indigenous people as First Australians and what should be their rights. In 1974, many years before Mabo and in the wake of the Woodward Report on land rights, he successfully moved a motion which said, "The Senate accepts the fact that the Indigenous people of Australia were in possession of this entire nation prior to the 1788 First Fleet landing at Botany Bay, and urges the Australian government to admit prior ownership, then introduce legislation to compensate the people now known as Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders for dispossession of their land." When we review Bonner's career and attitudes, it's important, I think, to put him in context, both in terms of where Aboriginal affairs policy was up to and the general federal political scene in the years when he was a senator. Bonner was born in 1922 under a palm tree on a small island in the Tweed River. He was a Jagua man. He lived his early years in the toughest of conditions, the fringe-dwelling life of so many of his people. He never knew his father, and he lost his mother when he was a young child. But he did have a very strong grandmother who looked out for him. He received minimal primary schooling and soon was working at various itinerant country jobs. As his grandson put it in his oration at Bonner's funeral, and I quote, "At age 15, he became his own man and he hit the road with a swag," unquote. As a young man, Bonner moved to Palm Island, where his wife had been sent after she struck her white employer's wife. His grandson said, and I quote, "It was on Palm Island, realizing the plight of his people, that he became actively involved in community affairs. He learned about racial togetherness, that Indigenous Australians could trust the non-Indigenous Australians and to a certain extent be guided by them," unquote. Bonner was given responsibilities on Palm Island. He saw how it was possible to work within the system to get results, as well as to challenge the system. When Bonner came to young manhood, it was the 1940s. Assimilation was the policy, and Indigenous people had not, for the most part, found their political voices. By the 1950s, things were starting to stir. In the 1960s, there were big changes. The 1967 referendum secured for the federal government power to make law for Aboriginal people in the states. And the land rights issue that would dominate the decades ahead was gaining traction. Aboriginal affairs became a pressure point within the coalition and bureaucratic ranks, and it became part of Labor's reform agenda of the late 60s and early 70s. More militant Aboriginal leaders were emerging. In 1972 came the establishment of the Tent Embassy outside Parliament House. The times were indeed changing in policy and in politics, and it was into this tumultuous scene of upheaval that Bonner was thrown when he arrived in the Senate towards the fag end of the coalition government. He'd gained administrative experience initially through work on Palm Island and then through his role in the One People of Australia League, OPAL. The conservative OPAL, founded by white people, which worked in housing and welfare, looked to the integration of Aboriginal people into the general culture. Bonner had also developed a close and friendly relationship with Pat Killoran, who was head of the Queensland Department of Aboriginal Affairs, Aboriginal and Islander Affairs. Killoran was a controversial figure, but Bonner said of him, "He was a tower of strength to me as a sounding board." This background gives some insight into why Bonner became a Liberal. in a just published monograph on Bonner, seen Jacobs, Sean Jacobs writes that Bonner revered Menzies, had a strong Catholic faith, and believed in freedom of choice, resilience, and free enterprise. Also, through Opal and elsewhere, Bonner was moving in liberal thinking circles. For many new parliamentarians, hitting Canberra is a bracing experience, as we all know. We can imagine what it was like for Bonner. Under the normal party pressures, he was also having to define and defend his place in the increasingly activist Aboriginal world. In his maiden speech, Bonner declared, "I shall play the role which my state of Queensland, my race, my background, my political beliefs, my knowledge of men and circumstances dictate." He described in that speech the lot of those of my race in 1971 and said it would be an understatement to say that the lot of fellow Aboriginals is not a particularly happy one. He spoke of emotional scars of people who had been shot, poisoned, hanged, and broken in spirit until they became refugees in their own land. They had, he said, suffered enough from the stigma and paternalism, however well-intentioned it may have been. And they were most certainly not looking for handouts. He wanted Aboriginal enterprises encouraged, saying, "I ask for a greater degree of gambling on Australia's Indigenous population, who, since the arrival of the white man, have to a degree gambled just on existing." He appealed for tariff protection for boomerangs, which of course attracted headlines on the day. Unsurprisingly, Bonner angered the more radical Aboriginal leaders who were challenging the system and believed confrontation was the only way to get results. He endured attacks of being an Uncle Tom. For his part, he could use Aboriginal culture as a rhetorical weapon against his critics. For example, telling demonstrators approaching Parliament House, "This is Australia's Council of Elders, and you would not dare to walk into an Aboriginal Council of Elders, so why would you want to march into that one?" Bonner wanted to see more Indigenous people in the General Parliament, not a separate Aboriginal Parliament. He would be proud to see the number of current members. Peter Boehm, who went on to be a minister in the Fraser government, for a time sat on the back bench next to Bonner. And when I asked him about him, he remembered his sense of humour and his goodwill. And Boehm told me this: "When I first entered the Senate," and that was in 1974, "I was sat with Neville. On the first day, he pointed to the inkwell and told me solemnly that was where we put our tea money. He taught me so much about behaviour in the chamber and made me a better person." And Boehm went on to recall, "When we won the election in 1975, four of us were sat in the back bench of the government. And there was the Abbo, Neville," these are Boehm's words, "the Refo, Misha Lajovic, the Jew, me, and the rebel, Alan Misson. We called it Cockroach Corner." Bonner stressed about the Fraser opposition's blocking of supply, and he was relieved when the Governor General's sacking of the Whitlam government ended the pressure on Liberal senators. In the Fraser years, he had a mixed relationship with his government, one that was often scratchy. As a backbencher, he was a maverick. He crossed the floor some 34 times in his Senate years. But it's worth remembering, I think, that this was the era when coalition backbenchers were inclined to floor crossing, something that's very rare today. Early in the Fraser time, Bonner was part of the backbench revolt that forced Prime Minister Fraser to reverse the government's decision to scrap the funeral benefit for pensioners. Bonner was involved in parliamentary committee work, but he never rose further than his backbench position. And he often felt he was not consulted enough or given sufficient involvement. Indeed, he thought he should be a minister, a position I gather that he actually put to Fraser. Of course, like any backbencher, Bonner was going to run into blocks, find himself at times frustrated. In terms of how he was treated by his government, it's hard, I think, to separate the strands here. Did he get more or less opportunity because he was Indigenous? And what role did his own personality and abilities play? In his earlier parliamentary years, he often saw the point of view of the Queensland Conservative government when it was at odds with the Commonwealth, but later he became very critical of it. Tim Rouse from the University of Western Sydney, who has written on Bonner, says, as land rights became more bipartisan in federal politics, it tested his loyalties to Queensland's conservative politics. In particular, the Queensland conservative views that the state held reserves in trust for Aboriginal residents and that the government could decide, that is, the state government could decide what was best for Aboriginal people who were living on those reserves. By 1983, Bonner had lost support among power brokers in the Queensland Party and the enmity of the Queensland Nationals and Premier Joh Bjelke-Petersen. He was pushed to the unwinnable third place on the Senate ticket. He quit the Liberal Party and ran as an independent, getting a strong vote, but not enough to be returned to Parliament. He rejoined the Liberal fold some years later, and he was given life membership eventually. After his death, John Howard told Parliament that Bonner, and I quote, would always remind us who were less conscious of the experience of the Indigenous people, of what was expected of us. But he would never seek to set the Indigenous people of Australia apart from the rest of their fellow Australians. So what was Bonner's contribution when we look back on it? He was a parliamentary pioneer for his people. He spoke up for First Australians. He was his own person. He took stands of principle on a number of issues. Often finding himself subjected to conflicting pressures and buffeted about, he tried to find moderate ways through. At one level, Bonner was not a political high flyer, but at another, he was a beacon. I'll leave it there and look forward to your questions and discussion.
Michelle, thank you very much for a very considered paper. So we go to Professor Michael Reynolds. Michael.
Namandumarang, everyone. Good evening. Hello. That's Rajri. I'd like to certainly pay acknowledgement to the traditional custodians, owners of the lands in which we meet today. As an Aboriginal man, acknowledgement that goes quite deep, far more than a token. I'd like it to be thus tonight. I acknowledge the Tatamaligal people and the Caribal people from around these Ku-ring-gai lands from where I'm talking from today. The Cammeraygal people who traditionally looked after all those lands around around the Australian Catholic University. I'd like to acknowledge the Jagadal people of Uncle Neville Bonner, and acknowledge his people, because I think an elders past, present, and emerging. It's interesting, sort of reflecting on Senator Bonner. There was, and I'm going to talk off the cuff for a large part of this, because he achieved many, many things for Aboriginal people. And I don't see him as one person, you know, and I'm not sure he saw himself as that either. He did an incredible amount as a man, but sort of he continued a long line of people who were proud of their culture and wanting to represent government and represent themselves well, to make sure that their people were strong, not just him, his family and his culture remained strong, and that it was strong for all Aboriginal people around Australia. And it's my firm belief that the strength of our Aboriginal cultures is incredibly important for all Australians, not just for Aboriginal people. It is dearly important to them, but it's important for all Australians for healing. Neville Bonner, as we just heard, came into the world at a very difficult time for Aboriginal people. Born in 1922, was a tough time, and worked hard, as many Australians did. He described himself as an ordinary Australian, and it was probably leading up to that 1967 referendum, as we heard, when he joined the Liberal Party, that his desire to make a better place for Aboriginal people was fired within him. Prior to 1962, there wasn't an opportunity for Aboriginal people to vote in elections. It wasn't until the Menzies government brought that in 1962 that Aboriginal people had a chance to vote in federal elections. And it wasn't until 1965 that people could vote in all states, with a Queensland government passing that legislation then in 1965. Just for reference from me, I was born to a Stolen Generations person. My mum was Stolen Generations, and she was born in the 1950s. So she was born at a time when her parents certainly didn't have a chance to vote and speak up for what was right for her or her people, and certainly she never really felt recognised. And it's interesting, as you know, there's this talk of intergenerational trauma and children of Stolen Generations people. And there's this great fight that we see in the youth of Aboriginal Australia today. And I suppose I see myself at the moment, this fight to be recognised and to be seen. And when I reflect on Senator Bonner and his contribution, even just being there, the fact that he was just there, was a great beacon, as you've so nicely described, a great beacon for Aboriginal people, because he showed that it was possible. We have 7 there now, 1 coming, and then 11, I think, elected federal representatives, which I think, and across all political persuasions, and I think Bonner sort of taking the torch, particularly on the Liberal side of politics, was an interesting one, particularly at the time, but gave a great hope that that Aboriginal people could be represented in the Australian story. There's been a lot of talk about voice, and there's been a lot of talk about inclusion, and there's a great benefit for the Australian story to have elected Indigenous representatives. And it was, he lamented when he left the Senate in 1983 that there was no one else to follow him. It wasn't until Aidan Ridgway came in for the Dems in, I think it was 99, that we actually had someone else in federal parliament. And it hasn't really been until the last 20 years that we've had a greater amount of representation. So when we talk about it was in the past, this representation, we need to get over these things. It's only just now that we've had people in the Houses of Parliament with maybe for the first time some sort of critical mass where we can have the discussions that we've needed to have for over 200 years. And I thank the people for standing it. I thank the people on all sides of politics for putting forth their voices and continuing Bonner's legacy of creating a better place for his people. Bonner worked hard. He highlighted the need for land rights. He highlighted the need for recognising the incarceration rates in Australia. He highlighted the depression and suicide. We had one of the highest youth suicide rates in the world, particularly when we're looking at our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We need their voices to fix these problems. And without these problems, they won't be fixed. We know this. We know this paternalistic way doesn't work. Senator Bonner knew it didn't work, and he lended his voice and influenced so many people through all his years in politics to forward the conversation and to challenge people's views. It was a difficult time. There was discrimination, but he put his head down. He got on with it. He worked hard, and he made changes where he could make changes. I admire the resolve in which he went about his business. I know he crossed the floor 34 times. A lot of these times was around, certainly was around Aboriginal issues. And he was never a, it was a, I think the quote was, he's a token to no one. He was a puppet to no one. He had an incredibly strong character, and that's been remarked upon by several people that had worked with him. So when I look at the legacy of Senator Bonner, it's the fact that he was there. It's the fact that I'm here tonight. It's the fact that we have people like, not necessarily by myself, but we have Aboriginal people in Parliament. We have their institutions, which don't only improve the lot for Aboriginal people, but it actually helps improve us as a nation. It improves our institutions. It improves our universities. So we're informed to make the changes that we need to make. There's, from the 1967 referendum, there was it laid really the foundations to make laws in respect for Aboriginal people. And if we want to, protect our Aboriginal peoples, as Senator Bonner did and as others do, we need to make sure that we honour that commitment. We need to honour Senator Bonner's commitment. We need to honour the commitment of the Australian people at that referendum, to make sure that we include those voices. Now, how those voices are included, look, that's still up for some debate. But if we're not informed by those sorts of voices, we're not going to improve the lot for Aboriginal people in this country. If we don't have adequate representation for Aboriginal people to see that there's a path forward, we're not going to see people rise. I was the first person with any level of tertiary education in my family. I had nothing. I looked to people like Bonner, like Charles Perkins, to actually try to get ahead and understand how I could help Australia and my people more. So I might sum it up as thus, that Senator Bonner was a great man that did many, many things, and there's been many great people before him and great after him. I think we need to remember the importance of having him there and the importance of listening to him, of listening to his voice and coming with a sense of humility to try to understand, to fix the solutions that Bonner tried to fix back in his time and that we're still trying to fix today. That it's a truly collaborative approach where we preference those voices when we're trying to fix these sorts of problems with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. I think it'd be best that we maybe discuss, and we're welcome to take many other questions. I thank you very much all for your time.
Michael, you spoke about Neville Bonner. You mentioned your role. You mentioned him in respect to the Australian Catholic University. You mentioned, of course, I mentioned introducing you, your position as an associate professor at the ACU. So is there any particular interest in the ACU in the late Neville Bonner?
ACU have always have had a long interest in looking at celebrating Indigenous cultures in this country, being the 50th anniversary of Senator Bonner's election to Parliament, we did commission a short. Looked at a short documentary that we've looked at, and we've also helped support various people's what I'm trying to say, efforts to make sure that his story is remembered. But my specific work around ACU is looking at our health sciences our program and embedding Indigenous perspectives within that.
Thank you. Now, Michelle, you, I think, arrived in Canberra in the Canberra Parliamentary Press Gallery in the same year that Neville Bonner arrived in the Senate. I think that's right, 1971. And I worked in Parliament House from early 1976. As I recall, in those days, the senators were known for being senators, but they didn't interact as much with the House as they would today. Do you have any personal recollections of Senator Bonner when he was in the Senate?
Look, I must say only in general terms. As I was saying before, the backbenchers, I think, in those days were a bit more individualistic than many of them are today. So he was one of a number of people who did from time to time stand up on issues, and as the years went on, he became, of course, particularly prominent on the Aboriginal issues that were developing. And during those years, there were many battles over Aboriginal affairs. The Tent Embassy was a long-running saga, and the general arguments between the Fraser government and the Queensland government were was a flashpoint from time to time. So he was part of all that mix.
Thanks. Now, Michelle in her paper mentioned Sean Jacobs, who's on the call today. Now, he has recently written, and it's published but soon to be released, an entry in the Australian Bibliographical Monograph series published by Connor Court on the topic of Neville Bonner. Now, Sean's in the discussion today, so Sean, you're welcome to come in anytime you want to about your work on Bonner. I think there is some years ago, a substantial book on Neville Bonner, but perhaps not the easiest book to access, and you've got into this area where short monographs of distinguished political figures in Australia becoming quite popular because they're easy to read and quickly consumed. So you're welcome to come anytime you want to, and then we proceed on. Just give a hand function if you want to come in. Sean, do you want to say something?
Yeah, thank you, Gerard, and great. Thanks very much, Michelle and Michael, for those wonderful, wonderful words. So as Gerard mentioned, I have just recently put together or published a biography on Neville Bonner through Connor Court Publishing as part of the Biographical Monograph series. And until this book had come out, my book had come out just recently, there was only one other book that existed on Bonner at the time, which Gerard just touched on then, which was the 1979 biography by journalist Angela Berger, and it kind of surprised me that there'd been bits and pieces written, and Michelle did touch on it about Tim Rouse's Senate biography, other sort of articles that Michael had touched on as well. And I was really quite surprised that not a lot had been done to actually update or modernise his legacy for a newer generation and his story as well. I actually had just a really brief question for Michelle and Michael. I sort of found that putting this together, Bonner's story together, it was kind of interesting to look back at the time. And, you know, Bonner said that there were lots of issues that were seen through time, you know, looking back from today or from at least the 90s before Bonner passed away, as Indigenous issues that weren't actually considered Indigenous issues at the time. So, for example, the Mornington Island or Aurukun issues were kind of self-government issues or issues around self-management versus actually being Indigenous issues. And it kind of made me think about how we look back on those times and thinking if, has Indigenous affairs become, more or less acute over time. Certainly they were running hot in Bonner's time, you know, in late 1960s, early 70s. But then, as Michael articulated, there's lots of things that we look through an Indigenous affairs lens today. So Michelle and Michael, thanks so much again, and Jared for putting on today. But I'd just be interested in both your perspectives there about if Indigenous affairs is more acute or less acute than Bonner's time in your perspective.
Let's start with Michael, then go to Michelle. Michael?
It's interesting. I come across this a lot where Indigenous issues are often put in silos. And there are very specific things that are important for Indigenous people and really are quite specific to Indigenous people. I think of it, you know, Australia is made up of a lot of peoples. You know, even if we look at genders, you know, if we look at just men and women. And if we look at women, there are some things that are specific to women that are incredibly important, which can only be owned by women or of importance to women and need to be determined by women. Policies need to be determined by women. Take domestic violence, for example. But still, women are a very important part of Australian society. There are mothers, there are daughters, there are, you know, it's important to have this adequate representation, people in the room speaking with different perspectives. If we don't hear those perspectives, we miss some of the truths in what people have to say. And it's because of their background, and they shouldn't just be resigned just to women's issues. Really, there needs to be that conversation everywhere. And I firmly believe that if we continue to put Aboriginal people in silos, and Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people can only deal with Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander issues, I think there's a great folly in that. I think it goes beyond land rights when we're looking at climate change, land management. We need to make sure we include those voices in our decisions and consider them in the way that they should be, because they're providing perspectives that are incredibly important for making the right decisions, both for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but for all of us to live together.
Michelle, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that the decades, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, were incredibly important for recognising some central issues that went to Indigenous affairs, and land rights was obviously a core issue and continued over those decades. And a lot of progress clearly was made on the way through. I think also, if you look at the present, that we can divide Indigenous issues into two general categories, the symbolic issues, and we have had the debate about recognition, and unfortunately that's not made the progress that we might have hoped 6 or 7 years ago that it might have, how you best represent the Indigenous voice and attitudes. And on the other hand, what John Howard used to call practical reconciliation, which is all about the progress of Indigenous communities and individuals going to actual living standards, the whole closing the gap thing, the question of equality of opportunity, which is easy to say and incredibly difficult to deliver in many circumstances. So I think that we have become particularly aware of the importance of the Indigenous community, their role in our history, and the need to address some of these issues of their place, past and present, but also their circumstances. I agree with the point that it's part of a general community, and many of the issues that they will be involved in the broad issues of the whole community, just like other groups within our society. But I do think that these two strands have to be both addressed, the symbolic issues, the question of place and recognition, but also the practical issues of conditions and opportunity.
Jacqueline.
Thank you both for your presentations tonight. It's really very, very important and also quite fascinating. I think I recall a quote from Senator Bonner where he said that he was first a Christian, second an Australian, third a Queenslander, I think, and then fourth a member of the Liberal Party. How important was faith to the man as a parliamentarian and as a politician? And how was that reconciled at the time? And what we're seeing in current times, faith being questioned and being something quite critical about people of faith in politics. How did that make Senator Bonner the man that he was?
Look, I can't speak exactly for what Senator Bonner was thinking, but our laws in this country, have been based on good values, on good Christian values, really. Whatever your faith is, people come into life having a belief that something is right, and it's a guiding path you need to stay true to. And I think he did that. And whether it's a Christian faith or whether it's another faith, if you lose that faith, then you become lost. And I think that must have given him great comfort in those what I can only imagine were quite lonely times in Parliament, when he did feel different, when he was the only Indigenous man there, and where people didn't understand his culture. And I equally believe that his culture stood him in, gave him great strength in those corridors as well.
Sean, do you have any particular take on
that? I believe he thought he was right.
There's not a lot of detail about this question of how his faith affected his decisions and how he went about his life. But I think that we can see that it obviously influenced his values. It probably, to an extent, drove his moderation, his desire to bring people together rather than divide them. So it was a general driver, I think, of his politics to that extent.
Just before we go to Michael Bohm, Sean, do you, in writing your monograph, any particular insights into Neville Bonner's Christian faith?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jared. So I think what Michael and Michelle is spot on. Jacqueline, your question about that cascading sort of criteria of where he his commitments were came after he arrived in Canberra, or just before he arrived to Canberra, and he said that his commitments were to God, nation, state, and then party in that actual rank order. That's what he would be a senator for. Faith had really been his ticket to self-improvement. So he was a devout Catholic. How he actually became a Catholic, I'm not quite sure. I couldn't actually find a lot on that. But in the late 60s, he headed up the One People of Australia League, which was a very Indigenous welfare agency, very much focused on integration, assimilation, and building skills and integrating into mainstream Australia. So faith had really been his ticket to improvement and integration and assimilation while balancing that faith as well. So just adding to Michelle and Michael's points there.
Thanks, Sean. So go Michael Bohm and then Anne Henderson. Michael?
Backbenchers generally don't have a great influence on the decisions of prime ministers. But my question to Michelle, and hopefully my cousin Peter, who was Aboriginal Affairs Minister, might have an opportunity to respond to this too. But to what extent did Neville Bonner influence the progressive approach of Malcolm Fraser on Aboriginal affairs matters?
Well, let's start with Michelle, then go to Peter.
Well, I think he would have had some influence. I think that Malcolm Fraser, though, did have a progressive attitude generally in terms of race issues, as we know, and we remember his attitude on apartheid and so on. I think, though, within the government, there were obviously a whole lot of different pressures in this area, and dealing with the Queensland government added another one. But Bonner would have been one of the influences.
Peter, do you want to make a comment?
Am I on now?
Yes.
Two things. First of all, the greatest ally I had as minister was Malcolm Fraser. He may have been coming from a different position as a patrician, but he ended up in the same place, and that was very, very helpful. Secondly, Neville Bonner played very little role in my work, and that's a criticism of my work and me, that we didn't take more notice of the only Indigenous member of our party. I might just add that as government whip in the Senate during the Fraser years, I want to bear out what Michelle said. It was very difficult to corral the Liberal senators. It was like trying to herd cats. I'll pass back to you, Jared.
Thank you, Peter. I remember those days well. That would apply to many of the senators, wouldn't it? Not just a few. Many.
You and the reps too.
Yeah.
The reps too. Yeah. Anne?
Yeah, I've unmuted, but I think I'm completely blacked out. I'm blacked out.
Wow.
I'm interested that this has happened on an anniversary to someone who sort of had faded in the memory of Aboriginal, Indigenous Australians' history. And I wonder how the Indigenous younger people are being given the information we're discussing tonight. Is it getting out to the younger ones what Neville Bonner contributed? And if it isn't, will there be some change in this? And maybe Michael and Sean could help them. Michelle, you're at the conversation. You might have a better idea too.
Okay, well, let's start with Michael.
It's been out just in little dribs and drabs. I don't think it's really gone out in a large way. There's been some pieces from various corners, which I'm sure that Sean and Michelle can probably speak to more than I can, but a little bit through NITV, but not to a great extent. And I think more needs to be said about him by Aboriginal people as well, and maybe by some of our current elected representatives reflecting on that. I know that. I think Ken Wyatt's said a few words, but Sean, Michelle?
Well, I think it's the neglect in a way is part of the fact these days that politics is very much in the moment, that a whole lot of people who were around at Neville Bonner's time would also be neglected and not known by today's politician. So it's not just Neville Bonner, it's a wider fact that history is not so much remembered, so highly regarded these days as important to know about.
Do you want to make a contribution?
Yeah, just very quickly. So Michael's point is correct and Michelle's too. I think there's just an indifference to a lot of historical figures, regardless of where people sit on a political spectrum or how their contributions to public life. And, you know, I hope at least in my biography, I've been able to make it a digestible or deliver it in a digestible way for younger Australians to actually keep pace with and absorb. But yeah, that both those points are correct, but it's spot on about it just being across the board versus, you know, any particular figure.
Now, I'm not sure whether anyone knows the answer to the question, but Neville Bonner, as you know, he joins the Liberal Party, I think, from what I've read, Michelle's paper and others, around the time of the 67 referendum. And then he gets a Senate casual vacancy position in 1971. That's 4 years later or thereabouts. That's very quick promotion. So who was his benefactor in the Liberal Party, which was then shared a ticket with the, what was then called, I think still the Country Party. It was very much the minority party in the Queensland non-Labor parties. But how did he get there so quickly? This was a casual vacancy.
He had run in the election, the 70 election. He'd been number three on that ticket and not got in. And therefore, when the vacancy came up, he sort of had a claim to it. But I think it's an interesting question. Sean would remember the names of those in the party who supported him around that time. I must say I've forgotten, but it is odd. It struck me as odd that he was able to get through the Queensland Liberal Party, even though he had conservative values, even though he was mixing in these circles and there was overlap with Opal and so on. But it is a bit extraordinary.
Sean, do you have any names that you can recall?
Yeah, so there were in particular, the standout one was John Gorton, was actually very helpful, of course, from the Queensland Liberal Party, but at a federal level, Gorton and him had a good relationship, which wouldn't have done him anything, particularly bad in terms of having a prime minister on board. But particular figures that Bonner spoke about were the Postmaster General, Alan Holm. There was Reginald Swartz and a few others. But I think, what Michelle noted is correct, that what really got him on the radar was actually just making the decision on the fly one night at a Liberal fundraiser to put his hand up for the ticket for the 1970 election. So it just made him the natural ascendant choice for 71 to fill that vacancy for Dame Annabel Rankin. But those were kind of his allies at the time in the party, and I think, really kind of helped with his ascendance.
And, of course, as you know, John Gorton's still Prime Minister in 1970 when he gets on that ticket. So that's not bad to have the PM on side. Okay, so I think Jacqueline wants to come in, is that right?
Yes, thanks, Jared. I'm glad to have another go. I'm interested if you can share any insights into the relationship that the senator had with the emerging Aboriginal activists at the time. You know, you mentioned the Tent Embassy, but, you know, there were some very well-known names of really prominent Aboriginal activists. What was that relationship like?
I think that from what I understand, it was difficult up and down to the extent that they just thought that he was too much willing to work within the system and, of course, was part of the Liberal Party, and they were more to the left, more militant, but determined to challenge the establishment, as it were, challenge the system. And, of course, there would have been a generational difference too. He was middle-aged. A number of those activists in those were quite young in those days, those around the Tent Embassy. So there was certainly, I guess, some identification in that they were Aboriginals, but nevertheless conflict within that identification.
Right. So
Sean might have a more nuanced view on that.
I had nothing to add. That's okay.
Sorry, Sean. Yes.
Nothing to specifically add there. That's
all right. So, final question. Can we always finish on time? So, we just should say a little bit about when he died. I don't think we've covered that. But apart from that, he came back to the Liberal Party, as you know, but he lost pre-selection. And I remember at the time it was a surprise that he lost pre-selection. So does anyone remember to whom he lost pre-selection, which led him to leave the Liberal Party? And then he came back to the Liberal Party and I think was welcomed back. And then just briefly when he died. So let's start off with Michelle and then I don't know who knows the answer here.
He lost pre-selection to Kathy Sullivan, Kathy Martin, and she apparently offered to actually stand down so he could be number one on the ticket. But anyway, that didn't go down well. McGibbon was the second person on the ticket, and I've forgotten who was the third. Someone will remember who was the third person on that ticket. When he died, of course, he was much praised by the Liberal establishment. I mentioned John Howard's words, Robert Hill in the Senate, and many others, I think, thought he had been badly done by, that the wrong decision had been made back in the early 80s. So he was recognised, but fortunately he was recognised before he died by the Liberals, who, as you mentioned, gave him life membership.
Sean, do you want to make a comment? Sean or Michael?
Yes, sorry, just a really quick one. That's a really good point about who was in on third, because obviously Bonner was in that position and he ran as an independent. So I don't actually know who ended up running as third for the Liberals for 83. I just would really make the point quickly that it was actually Bob Hawke that reached out to him on the eve of the election in 83 and spoke to Bonner on the phone and, you know, lamented that where Bonner sat and said that if things didn't work out, that something could be worked out for Bonner. And that's how he is set up, I guess, his post-political career and serving on the ABC board and other causes as well. But, that's probably just a quick point I'd like to add in about that late 80s or mid to late 80s and 90s journey that Bonner was on after politics.
Michael, anything before we do, just remind us for when he dies. He dies in 1999, was it? 1999.
Okay. Yep.
Does anyone know where he's buried? We must find that out. Okay, Michael, do you want to make a final comment?
I think going beyond here, we just said we don't recognise historical figures enough, and this is one figure I really don't ever want to forget, that I think none of us should forget.
We're right on time, folks. So, look, that's a very good point to end on. Look, I'm very grateful to Michelle Grattan and Michael Reynolds for their papers. They'll be published in time in the Sydney Papers Online, which Anne Henderson will put out as soon as she gets them. Thank also to Sean Jacobs for his contributions. Now the book Neville Bonner will be selling here at the Sydney Institute. Anne's in here with a message, you can tell me, Anne. I won't have time to read it.
I just wanted to say this, they're going to put a statue up with Leonard Lyons, so he is going to start to come back.
Oh, hang on, they are going to put a statue up.
He's going to Lyons, Dorothy Tagby, and right. Neville Bonner.
Well, Anne tells me that
in Canberra
there'll be a statue to Leonard Lyons, Dorothy Tagney and Neville Bonner. So there you go. You hear all the news here. And I should also, as I was just saying, we'll sell copies of Sean's book when it comes out through Connor Court, with whom we have a very good relationship, as we do with the ACU. And I should also say that this will go up online on YouTube when our very able technical people do it. So thanks again to Nick in Newcastle and to Naomi down here in Sydney for putting this together for us tonight. And it's great to be able to remember Neville Bonner on his, only met him once, but on his 50th anniversary of his entry into the Senate. And it's quite a tribute to him that we're paying this attention to him 50 years after that event. So well done to our speakers and to all those who made contributions and for those who joined us tonight. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.